Hey, everybody. Welcome once again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very, very, very excited for this week's show. Here to talk Return of the Jedi, the first of any of the original Star Wars trilogy that we've covered on this show, is one of my favorite filmmakers, one of my favorite people. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Jackson Stewart. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you for having me on and for that that fine intro you just gave me. Very kind.
Well, thank you for doing this. Yeah, it occurred to me as I was preparing for this, we've covered the new Star Wars movies, Force Awakens, Last Jedi. We did a show on Phantom Menace years ago, but we've never done one of the original trilogy. So this is uncharted territory.
No, that's crazy. I'm very surprised to hear that, but
we're bad at being a podcast, is what I'm trying to say.
No, that's cool, man. I mean, I like that. It's like leave the obvious ones for like way late in the game. I'm totally on board with that.
Yeah,
I like doing the deep cuts and then working your way up right. Over time. That's rad.
Did you have a good Friday the 13th? Did you get to watch any Friday the 13th?
No, I got in a fight on Facebook with a bunch of people about how good the 13th Part 5 is, but I didn't get to watch any of them. I did watch The Mutilator with a couple friends of mine who had never seen it, which holds up. Like gangbusters, and it's always a blast to show that movie to people that have never seen it. But I didn't watch any of the OG Friday the 13th, unfortunately. Did you?
I spent most of my day because I was working from home, so I had Crystal Lake Memories on because I felt like, all right, that's cool. Just greatest hits. And then Friday night watched Jason Takes Manhattan and Jason X because I don't usually get to those. Like, I feel like every time Friday the 13th comes around, I watch one of the first five or like two of the first five. Those are the ones that are in rotation the most for me. So, went with some later ones and they're still not my favorites in the series. I am a Jason X apologist. I'm less a fan of Jason Takes Manhattan.
Yeah, I mean, the problem I think with Jason Takes Manhattan is it's like the teaser trailer that they did for that is so much better than the actual movie.
Right.
That you're like, okay, well, I got more entertainment out of this 40-second basically commercial for the film than the entirety of this thing them spending the majority of this movie on a boat and then going to Vancouver or whatever. It's not my cup of tea.
And I'm going to say some things slightly controversial, and then we'll talk about Return of the Jedi. I'm a fan of this person and this actor. I enjoy him every time he shows up and stuff. I've had the opportunity to meet him, as I'm guessing you have as well. He was always super nice. So this is nothing against him as a person. He has been the ambassador for the series for years and years and years, and I feel like helped keep Friday the 13th alive. But I came to the realization watching Friday 8 and Jason X that I'm not as big a fan of the Kane Hodder Jason as I thought I was.
Yeah, I mean, it's I really like his design in the 7th entry in New Blood. Like, I love how he looks in that, and I think he brought a lot of cool things to it. I mean my take on it has always been like he's kind of had like some of the worst entries in spite of him being a good Jason.
Okay.
So it's like it's a little I sort of get where you're coming from on it. But I think I think he does well with it. Like, I love how he is in Part 7. I mean, my favorite Jason out of any of them is Ted White from Part 4. Yeah. Like, he is absolutely perfect. Like, he's menacing, he's scary, he just looks exactly how I want Jason to look. But you know, Kane, I think had kind of a hard, he was not dealt the best hand with, you know, the Friday the 13th that he got to be in. And it's like, you know, they're widely considered some of the worst of like the entire series. You know, I know there's a lot of Jason X love, and I think there's a lot of really fun stuff in that movie. But I mean, I don't think anyone's favorites are Part 8 or Jason Goes to Hell. You know,
no, I don't think so. It was, and some of it honestly may be because, like I said, I've watched those first five so many times that I think. Because I think as a kid, Kane Hodder was my Jason, and that's what I thought of Jason, where he's like big and angry and sort of heavy breathing all the time and really brutal when he grabs someone or hits them or whatever. And so then I've watched, you know, those first five so many times now and over the years that to come back to that version of Jason was like, oh, wait, this isn't Jason. This is something totally different. So maybe I just need to wrap my head around. What
yeah, you know, well,
to it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's, I honestly think his, I mean, my favorite, you know, portrayal of him as Jason is honestly the Friday the 13th game, that came out recently. I mean, like, how he acted that and like the mocap and everything is like exactly how I want Jason to be. And then you can just kind of reskin him with whichever, you know, favorite costume that he had over the course of the franchise. But, you know, I mean, for what he did in that, I think he brought a ton to it. But, yeah, I definitely get where you're coming from on it. I think it's a valid criticism.
All right. So let's talk Return of the Jedi. This was, you had suggested this, so I'm fascinated as to why you chose this instead of Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back to talk about a Star Wars movie. Why go right to Jedi?
Well, you know, part of my thing with these is that I like going to these sort of like underloved entries totally. That had like a very big effect on me, you know, mm-hmm. and because I think there's sort of a weird thing. I don't entirely know why this is, but, you know, everyone seems to love Empire the most, which is, it's, you know, not my favorite of the original trilogy. For my money, my favorite has always been Return of the Jedi. And a lot of that is because of the ending and, you know, just a lot of interesting turns that I think the story takes, and you know, it feels very complete and fully realized, and there's just a lot of strong turns in it. But you know, it's a movie I've like heard dumped on endlessly, you know, even to this day. It's like I've heard people just be like, oh, it's terrible, it's unwatchable, like the Ewoks suck, and you know, just whatever random thing. And you know, it's typically, it's like once I start having a conversation with someone and getting into the nitty gritty of it, it's like there's usually not it's one of these things where it's like kind of like the general consensus of the public has informed their opinion on the quality of this movie,
right,
versus like their individual experience with it. Or you know, it's like people just have a thing of like you know, kind of like writing off a movie based on the public sentiment around it, you know, whether it's like they like it or they don't like it. And, you know, over the course of time that obviously, you know, the real classics kind of come to they rise to the surface, you know. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with this, but, you know, Vertigo, when that came out, was like basically panned and, you know, was like a box office bomb. And, you know, Hitchcock was like, honestly, kind of ashamed of it for a little while, and you know, blamed Jimmy Stewart for the movie tanking. And I think his wife actually like wasn't even a fan of it, oddly enough, even though she was like super honest with him and seemed to be pretty dead on for most of his films, but. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, that's everyone's favorite movie in the world now, you know, some 50 or whatever years later, and it was not for a very long time. And, you know, kind of in recent years, the thing I found really interesting with, like, you know, Halloween 3, for example, was when I was in high school, everyone hated that movie. And they're like, oh, it's the one that Michael's not in. It sucks. It's shit. Da, 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 da. And, you know, now it's like a lot of people will say that's my favorite Halloween movie out of the entire franchise, including the first one, or like people like it better than the first one. And it's like, that's always been the same movie. It's just people's relationships with them kind of change over time. And I think once people finally accepted, like, yeah, they tried something different and didn't want to go back to the Michael Myers formula with this, then they were able to, like, accept it on its own merits and realize that it was a good movie. And much in the same way, Return of the Jedi has always kind of been like that for me, where it was, you know, just like a long dumped upon movie that I always felt was, like, really strong in a story, character, and thematic level that I think in a lot of ways is better than Empire Strikes Back, which I'm sure I'll get some hate for that, but it is just my opinion.
When I was a kid, Jedi was definitely my favorite, and I think that's because it has probably the most kind of action in it and the most, like, set pieces, and because it's about paying things off, you know, so it's sort of the most rewarding, because Empire is really just about setting more things up and pulling the characters apart and sending them in different directions. And, you know, it has to be as the middle chapter, and Jedi is the one that pulls everybody back together and we win, and, you know, evil dies and good wins and we all dance. and I think, I don't know. I feel like when they were re-released as the special editions back in, like, 97?
Yeah, that's right.
I think that was when I was sort of watching them again with new eyes, because I like Star Wars, like, and I've seen the movies a bunch, but I don't think I would classify myself as, like, a Star Wars guy, where I know the names of, like, ships and planets and...
No. I mean, I don't either. I mean, like, I know, you know, the obvious ones, like the X-Wing and Millennium Falcon.
Right.
That, but I mean, it's like, yeah, the sort of, like, intense level of detail where, you know, you become like a Star Wars encyclopedia.
Right.
Like, I'm certainly not that.
Yeah, so I don't have that same level of buy-in. So when I was rewatching them again, I was like, oh, okay, you know, Empire, I feel like, was the more interesting to me at that time. But I don't know. I've never been someone who has to shit on Return of the Jedi, because, like you said, there becomes, like, this almost company line where, like, oh, we've all decided the Jedi's the bad one, so we just repeat that. Years ago, this is so off topic, but, like, years ago, I was writing a thing about the movie Gigli, and I'm not even saying Gigli's a great movie, but for the number of people...
Go ahead and say Gigli is a great movie.
For the number of people who say it's horrible, it's unwatchable, it's one of the worst movies ever made, I'll bet if you polled them, like, less than a third have actually seen it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I mean, that's like, it's this weird groupthink deal that's kind of overtaken most of the population in recent years. And I feel like a lot of that is, you know, due to social media and stuff, where people are just afraid to kind of, like, voice an outside the box opinion on one of these things. But yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm sure most people that you talk to be like, oh, Gigli is one of the worst movies ever made. And then if you ask them if they've actually seen it, the answer is no.
Right.
And it's kind of the same reason why, you know, Plan 9 from Outer Space was considered the worst movie of all time for years and years and years. And I can point to 100 movies that are way, way, way worse than that movie, to the point where it's like, you can't see what's going on in them. You can't hear the audio in them. I mean, like, there were, like, borderline unfinished, whereas that one, it's like, it certainly can't be, and, you know, it kind of wears its budget on its sleeve, and it's certainly not the smartest movie ever made, but it's entertaining, and a lot of movies aren't. So Yeah, I've just I find that mentality really weird, and I think a lot of the time it's not actually like based in how people look at it, with the, people's like personal relationships with that specific movie. It's just kind of based on whatever the consensus is at the time.
And so that's sort of been where Jedi has lived for years within the original trilogy, where it's like, oh, Jedi's the bad one because Ewoks, you know?
Yeah. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's like, it's so odd to me that, like, I feel like it's very telling to see how much people hate, like, how deeply they hate Ewoks, because it's like, I kind of equate that with them, like, maybe being a bad person. I don't know. Because I'm like, these are like the cutest things in the world, and they overthrow like an imperial empire. And like, what is the problem there? It's like they have like their own tactics that are kind of like one of the really cool things with this, and you know, that not a lot of people are aware of. This is like dating back to, you know, the Apache Wars in like the 1800s. But one of the things like most people don't realize is, I'm getting like super deep on this, and I might sound like a complete idiot, but one of the things people don't realize is like the Apaches and stuff were basically like beating all of the white people back then, because they knew the land. They were able to like fire, you know, 16 arrows in a minute, versus, you know, back then it's like if you had a musket or a rifle, you could fire one bullet every 60 seconds. Right. And you know, they were just like kicking the shit out of, you know, all these Englanders that were coming over to colonize their areas. And basically what happened in that was they, you know, kind of realized that and would go to these like warring tribes and start talking to, you know, like the Cherokee or whoever, and saying like, hey, if you give us their battle plan, we'll totally hook you up and give you whatever we want. And so they'd get them to turn on each other. And that's really like why they ended up kind of losing that war, is because there was like a lot of infighting there that they never got over. And then it was ultimately like they just got swindled by, you know, rich white people, which seems to be kind of like something we're going through right now in our current political state. But you know, it was always really interesting to me that, like, you know, George Lucas and Richard Marquand or whatever kind of took that approach with the Ewoks, of like them knowing this terrain way better than, you know, these imperialists coming in to take it over and then them kicking the shit out of them. It's like, I think that's awesome. And, you know, like a really cool, bold move. Yes, they, you know, look like teddy bears, and that's maybe a little bit of an odd choice, but it's, you know, what it's rooted in, I think, is real and strong and pretty cool.
Well, and I think unfortunately, you know, any discussion of Star Wars is going to open up six more rabbit holes that, like, because you have to talk about it as this weird cultural thing, and it can't just be a movie. But, like, yeah, they look like teddy bears. Yes, they're cute. Were they designed to sell toys? Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the pushback on Ewoks is like, well, they're so clearly for kids, and it turns it into a kids' movie. And I guess I just don't – what has Star Wars been? Like, I'm not saying it was always directed at just kids, but
– no, it's totally weird. I mean, it's like – yeah, it's like this was always kind of meant as – an all-ages series, and it's right. Like I don't know why people are so like I feel like it's like the same people that just want Luke to like become a bad guy, you know, where it's like right, oh they right. want, you know, they want Superman or they want Batman to like, you know, cut Superman's head off because that's like some like weird badass thing, you know, where it's like I there's just a bizarre mentality around that type of stuff, like I just don't get, and I don't ever want to get. But yeah, I mean, these are movies basically designed for all ages, where, you know, you can I could show this to my nephew and niece, and they would have a very good time with it. And, you know, you can watch it being a 30-something man and still enjoy yourself. It's like, I don't see what the problem with that is.
Everyone has these different ideas of what Star Wars is supposed to be, and obviously we saw that in a big way when Last Jedi came out, because so much of the pushback against that movie was, well, it's not Star Wars. This isn't what Star Wars is supposed to be. And it's like, I don't know. I saw it. It seemed like a Star Wars movie. There were a bunch of Star Wars characters in it, and Luke, and there were lightsabers and spaceships. And to me, it seemed like a Star Wars movie. And I'm not the biggest Rogue One fan. And
yeah,
that's, you know, I know a lot of people are. And I do feel like some of that had to do with, like, well, that's the gritty Star Wars. Because, again, there are people who want that to be Star Wars. It should be for adults, and it should be darker and grittier. And maybe that's the rejection of Ewoks. Because as I watched Return of the Jedi today, I literally tried to understand, like, why Ewoks are bad. Why do we hate Ewoks? And
yeah,
I had the same reading as you, that it's definitely sort of a callback to you know, early Apache or Native American tribes. I think it underscores this idea of rebellion in terms of, hey, we're this small little band of people who are outnumbered and outgunned, and we have to beat back the big bad empire. And Ewoks represent that better than even the actual rebellion, which has spaceships and an army at their disposal.
Yeah, completely.
Ewoks have, you know, little hatchets and rocks and stuff, and they're still taking down whatever those things are called, not the AT-ATs, but the ones with the two legs. There you go.
Whatever.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can't quite wrap my head around why I'm supposed to hate Ewoks.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I just feel like it's one of these things that, like, some reviewer or something said at some point, and then everyone just accepted as fact rather than them kind of, like, looking at, you know, this in, like, a fully contextualized sense of, you know, where this fits in history and all of that. And, you know, it's just always, that's always been sort of a puzzling thing to me. And, you know, I mean, it's like if you ask someone, like, why they don't like this movie, that's, I guarantee, going to be the first thing they point to. And it's just this sort of, like, tangible detail that, is really not a problem. It's just they, you know, have heard that's bad from other people, or they, I mean, whatever, they might not like them, which is fine. It's like, not everyone needs to like this movie. Plenty right. of people choose not to, or it's not their cup of tea, and that's totally fine. And nothing I say will change that. But, I do feel like it's always kind of, like, worth looking back on these things over the course of time and just reexamining our relationships with them and seeing, you know, what is your actual experience watching this versus, like, what is the groupthink experience of watching this, you know?
The opening sequence, it's really like the opening 30 minutes, I guess. Everything from, you know, the Jabba's palace to the end of the Sarlacc pit. And I should mention, I was fortunate enough when I rewatched this today to watch the despecialized edition.
Me too.
Okay,
dude,
good.
That's crazy.
Because the Sarlacc, and I feel like that actually affected back in 97. I feel like that affected my enjoyment of Jedi a little bit because it had been tinkered with so much in terms of things that I really remembered, like the band, the girl with the lips.
Was now
a CGI thing.
I'm with you on that one.
the Sarlacc pit was different. The song at the end had been changed. There were all these new shots that weren't in the movie. So Jedi, I feel like, had been fucked with the most, which might have affected my rewatch of that movie. So I was watching it today. Everything from, you know, Jabba's palace to the end of the Sarlacc pit sequence, I think, is still, like, my favorite sustained set piece in any of the original Star Wars movies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's, like, you know, I mean, since the first movie, that's really, like, the only time you've kind of had everyone all in it together, you know, fighting their way out of this kind of impossible situation that they're in. And it's, like, it's super engaging and just, you know, top notch in every level. It's like an absolutely riveting sequence front to back, you know.
Well, and, like, you know, the original Star Wars, the cantina scene is so much fun because look at all the monsters, but or creatures, I guess I should say. But
yeah,
the Jabba sequence, I mean, is that totally sustained? And you get the giant Rancor monster. And you get cool action scenes and I think some really ambitious special effects in terms of like
it's like you get a badass like Ray Harryhausen monster right in the middle of this thing, and it's like I don't know why people just glaze over that. Like, that's fucking awesome. Like, I don't know why people are just like, eh, whatever. Like, it's just like, that's incredibly cool to see that in, you know, like a huge budget blockbuster movie, and it's like, it's stop motion and, you know, it looks great. It still looks great. And you know, it's like that whole sequence I think is really strong. I love all the choices that they make. I think it's really ballsy that they just kill Boba Fett right off the bat and toss him into this thing, because it's like, you know, I know a ton of people are like huge fans of that character, and I think he's like fine for, you know, the function he serves in the series, but I think it's rad that he, you know, just gets killed right off the bat. You know, Harrison Ford, super charming, and in this entry, like I also really like that he came back for this after Indiana Jones, because he certainly did not need to. And, you know, I remember hearing like Lawrence Kasdan, I think, wanted to kill him off early on, which I'm glad they didn't do that. But I think it's very cool that, you know, Harrison Ford was super game to come back and, you know, kind of realized like how much this series had, you know, boosted up his career and kind of, you know, made him into the movie star that he is today.
And I think part of the, again, this is probably not fair, me playing this guessing game as to why some people reject Jedi. Really, I should just be talking about, you know, why I like it or what's interesting about it. I think part of it too, as I'm sort of psychoanalyzing the anti-Jedi people, is that Han Solo is a little bit, I don't want to say underserved, but, you know, the whole back half of the movie, he's essentially being very reactive, and Leia is really more so calling the shots. And again, fast forward to The Last Jedi. I mean, a lot of, and same with the Boba Fett thing, honestly, it didn't play out the way that Star Wars fans wanted it to. Even still in 2018, when they watch it, they get pissed because, hey, Boba Fett should have had a cooler death. Well, he wasn't even a character. He was just a neat costume. Let's just...
Yeah, totally.
Like, what are we talking about? He was such a cool character. Like, no, he was a costume. And it's a cool costume, but, like, he's not a character at all.
No, not in any way.
And so his death, certainly undercuts what we might expect. So I feel like those two things, Boba Fett's death and the fact that Leia is way more proactive and sort of in charge, and Han is sort of following her around a little bit, I think leads to some of the pushback, and I think is echoed in a lot of the negative responses to Last Jedi last year, where you have people upset about these same issues. Hey, how come the women are in charge? How come you didn't do the thing that I wanted you to do with the character that I thought was going to have a bigger part? Those kinds of complaints, I feel like, are sort of also present in Jedi.
Yeah, I mean, to me, like, the thing you said about Han and Leia is, like, completely dead on. And, I mean, I think it's, like, people kind of want Han to, like, not change over time. And they just want him to be that dude who's, you know, in the cantina, who shoots Boba Fett, or shoots Greedo first. And, you know, it's just, like, a total, you know, swaggery badass. But it's like, I think it's really cool that he's like, you know, getting back into the swing of things after having been basically in a coma for however long. And, you know, Leia's the one who's kind of like taking the lead on this in a pretty cool way. I mean, it's like there's the whole thing too when they're on the speeder bikes in the forest. Like, she's the first one to jump on those. Like, and then Luke is like, wait, and then like jumps on and goes right after her. And it's like, there's no reason why she can't be, you know, like the lead in her story. And it's like, I think it's really cool to kind of see that sort of like shift in dynamics, but between the two of them, after Empire Strikes Back, you know, there's just a nice sort of, rhythm to it, and it feels earned. And I don't feel like it's, the kind of thing that it feels very natural to the story. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's no point in it where you're like, Han would never do that. It's like to me, everything he's doing in that kind of makes sense. And I love the character that she becomes over the course of this movie. And, you know, same with Luke. I mean, like, Luke is my absolute favorite in this out of any of the other entries that he's been in. And, you know, one of the things I kind of wanted to jump to is like early on in the, you know, the movie, because it's like from where the previous film left off, they have the whole bit of like, is Darth Vader actually my father? And, you know, like when that was kind of, left as a cliffhanger, I mean, I'm sure you were aware of this, but there was a lot of people that were like, oh, he's lying, or he's trying to get to him or manipulate him. And, you know, then they just stayed very clearly up front, like, no, he was your dad. And then, you know, both Obi-Wan and Yoda tell him in no uncertain terms, the only thing they can do that he can do is like kill his own father. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Luke is like completely resistant to that idea. And then at a certain point, you know, toward the end, when he's like fighting it out with him in the Emperor's throne room, he's like, you know, very much getting ready to kind of fall into his father's mistakes and, you know, kill him and basically like end up kind of repeating history. And it's like by him sticking to what he knows is right and, you know, like what's in his heart of like, I would rather die than turn to evil or like kill my own father, I think is really powerful and just does not get enough, doesn't get enough credit for like how cool of a turn that is, because it's just that is like a crazy twist in the story. And it's like, the other thing too is I really don't feel like you get any, most of these movies don't end with like the bad guy becoming the hero. And like, you know, it's like, it is a really, really bold choice to be like, okay, this guy who's like killed thousands of people, you know, is like basically like not human anymore, ends up saving the day, saving his son's life, sacrificing himself, you know, in order for his son to live, and, you know, basically getting this like good that was buried very deep down within him kind of like rekindled, you know, before he died. And it's like, it is such a, that's such like a huge kind of win for cinema and, you know, the story. And it just is not, I never hear anyone talk about that. And, it's always been something that's like had a huge effect on me.
It's really cool and it's earned. And I know we'll get back to this a little bit later on, but I do feel like as I was watching Jedi today, there were certain moments that maybe they were now too informed by things I know from other movies. Case in point, there's that moment at the end of Rogue One that I know everyone loves where Darth Vader just like massacres 15 people. Like he's the most powerful, most badass dude in the world. Okay, fine. I get that is cool as a scene, but then when you're watching, the end of Return of the Jedi and Luke is beating the shit out of him, you're like, well, how are these two people the same guy? How is this guy who I saw be so powerful in this other movie also this guy who is really taking a beating from Luke Skywalker? And again, I've never questioned it. It only popped into my head today because of Rogue One. And I love that scene. I mean, that's one of my favorite moments in the whole movie when Luke loses his shit. And it's just, it's amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and it's like, it's super, it's really interesting too, because I think as a viewer, it kind of exposes this sort of inherent need for violence or conflict or whatever that subconsciously exists in all of us, you know, wherever you fall in the political paradigm or whatever, because it's like there's a part in every one of us that watches this movie that wants the good guy to kill the bad guy and not you know, go down this path of like nonviolence or whatever. And so it's, I think there's something really interesting about that, that, you know, everyone's like, oh, cool. Like Luke's going to kill him. That's great. But then that ends up being like, oh, this would actually be like the worst thing that could happen because this is a good person, you know, and like him using violence is not going to solve these problems. And it's like, there's such a good message under there that I don't think, I just don't think it really gets talked about or discussed or like looked at in any, you know, deep or real or meaningful way. And, you know, it's like there's certainly some gratification you get out of seeing Luke chop Darth Vader's hand off. But it's ultimately like that's not the way to change things. You know, well, it's like that's the way to repeat patterns and get exactly where we are now.
Right.
You know?
Right. Which, again, going back to, you know, people are like, oh, Luke should have turned to the dark side. Well, then it just becomes a cycle. And this is a movie about breaking the cycle. Right.
Absolutely.
But I think it's also a necessary beat. Like you said, it's like cool and cathartic, I guess, to watch him lose his shit and chop off Darth Vader's hand. But also it's a kind of a necessary beat because, as you said, he's making a choice not to kill him. But that moment tells us he could if he wanted to. He has he has every opportunity, and he's obviously powerful enough to do it. So the reason he doesn't is because he makes a very conscious choice not to do it, not because he's outmatched or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that notion of, you know, I would rather die than become evil, I think is just incredibly strong. And I mean, I think it's so cool to have in this kind of movie, because, you know, most of these other things, it's like you would just never see that. It's like you would just see like, okay, they triumph and they kill the bad guy or beat the bad guy or whatever. And like, I certainly love a ton of movies where they do that, but it's just, it's a little more interesting to see how it's pulled off in the context of, you know, the overall story over, you know, the original three movies, and just what a kind of great payoff that is for the series.
Well, and I think when we get to that moment where Darth Vader sort of has the change of heart and decides, you know, I'm not going to let this guy just murder my son, and picks the Emperor up and throws him down the thing, I was thinking about, I think there's been some revisionism even on Lucas's part that the original trilogy is the story of Darth Vader. Like, no, it isn't. But it does complete an arc. You know, when he makes that choice, he becomes sort of a fully formed character. And it's interesting. And like I said, it's earned, and we've sort of gotten to that moment and we understand why he makes that decision. And so I do think that it makes the trilogy better as a whole because of where he started and where he ends. And then, of course, I thought about the prequel trilogy. And I think one of my issues with it is that arc is not as well defined or explored, I should say, because as we were saying earlier, you know, the first movie is sort of a wash. Like almost nothing happens in the first movie that really impacts Anakin Skywalker's journey. It certainly sets up, you know, the politics of how the Empire comes into being. And Lucas is way more interested in that than I am.
No, totally. I completely agree with you.
But just to watch Anakin go from like troubled to evil is way less interesting to me, especially when it's 100% the focus of this story being told. Whereas I think with the original trilogy, it's like this is just this character's arc, but it's not the focus of this whole story. This is a story that's telling the arc of a lot of different characters, and it's telling one larger narrative. And so this is Darth Vader's journey, but it's not the focus of everything the way that it is maybe in the prequels.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, you know, I think it's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, people sort of take on the prequels because it's like, to me, I feel like they just started them a little too early. And it's like, you know, I think if maybe episode two had been the first one, mm-hmm. or, you know, they'd had another entry between episode three and A New Hope, you know, that would have gone a long way. But it's like all the really interesting stuff kind of happens in the third installment. And then it's like you're kind of like, well, where was this for the previous two movies? Right. And it's a little rushed because it's like there's supposed to be this love story between, you know, Anakin and Padme. And that's basically like just given incredibly short shrift in the second movie, because they kind of have to like start foreshadowing like, oh, this guy's going to turn evil soon. And it's like, there's just, I completely like do not buy that Natalie Portman would fall in love with this dude who's like talking about murdering a bunch of kids and like women and stuff. You're just like, there is no, it's way too crazy of a starting point for their relationship. And then, I think the payoff of it in episode three is totally fine. And, you know, like that entry to me is the strongest of the prequels. You know, I know some people like Phantom Menace or whatever. There's definitely some positive aspects of the prequels, and I don't think they're as, I definitely think they're flawed and they have a lot of issues, but there's certainly some good stuff in them, and I like that it's George Lucas for, you know, if you want to call those movies failures or whatever, like they belong to him. They were not a movie. Those were not movies made by committee, you know, and it's like they make some pretty bold choices, which don't always work, but you know, it came from one author and he got to make the movies the way he wanted to, for better or worse. And to me, that's always like more interesting than something made by, you know, 15 executives right. that are just kind of like, you know, pushing buttons, essentially.
Well, again, it goes back to, and I think you were a much bigger fan of Justice League than I was. And that was a weird situation, well, obviously.
Initially, I was. I went back and revisited it, and I was like, okay, maybe this isn't that good. But
it was a weird situation, but my feeling has always, and I know that Zack Snyder was not able to complete it because of tragedy, so it was a different situation. But watching it, I just couldn't help but feel that even if I didn't like the Zack Snyder version, I would so much rather have seen that movie than the one that's touched by 15 hands and let's make it more like this and this focus grouped better and people want it lighter, so let's just digitally change the sky. And that's so much less to your point, you know, that's so much less interesting than, okay, George, make these movies that you want to make because you can, because you're self-financing them, he has to answer to no one, you know. And even if I don't love them, like I'm, like you said, at least he got to make the movies he wanted to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the whole, you know, it's really strange kind of seeing like the state that they're in over on the DC side, because it's like they, you know, had a mega hit with Wonder Woman, which seems to be universally loved, but they're in a very weird quandary now because they kind of have to undo all of the Zack Snyder elements that people were, you know, hyper critical of, which, you know, I agree with a lot of those points. It's a strange thing to just see these movies that are kind of made by committee not get really scrutinized in any way. And it's like they just hit this level where they're just pleasant enough and there's nothing like that's so glaringly wrong with them on first watch that, you know, people just kind of give them a pass. Mm-hmm. And it's just odd to me. It's like I'd much rather see the bold kind of misfire than, you know, the bland sort of like Necco wafer of cinema that, you know, so many of these blockbuster films have turned into.
Yeah, well, so okay, so speaking of filmmakers or distinct voices, this entry was directed by Richard Marquand after possibly going to David Lynch. And I've also heard David Cronenberg was considered. And neither one of them did it. And, you know, thank goodness, because while I would love to have seen their versions of this movie, we got their work instead. You know, Lynch goes on to make Blue Velvet essentially because Dune doesn't work. David Cronenberg is making Videodrome in the Dead Zone and just blowing our minds. So
totally.
So thank goodness they didn't do it. But so Richard Marquand, as a filmmaker yourself, I defer to you because you're watching this movie, I think, differently than I am. What do you feel like Marquand brings to this movie that maybe nobody else had brought to a Star Wars movie?
I mean, the thing with these movies is it's kind of like whoever's the director on these entries, I mean, at least with the original trilogy, they're essentially a guest star.
Right,
and it's for whatever Irving Kirshner brought to it, George Lucas was the boss on all of those. And it's like, it's directed by Irving Kirshner and directed by Richard Marquand, but, you know, the cast in this movie has kind of made no secret of the fact that, you know, I mean, Richard Marquand did a really cool horror movie called The Legacy, which I don't know if you've seen it, but it's really well made and interesting, and it's very cool.
But, is that the Sam Elliott one?
I can't remember if he's in it. It's like there's a cat on the cover.
I'm picturing the right disc. I can't, maybe Sam Elliott's not in it, but I am picturing Scream Factory put it out.
Yeah. It's a totally cool, you know, worthwhile movie to watch, but you know, he was fairly inexperienced when he made this, and, you know, a lot of the actors were not thrilled with him. You know, he kind of like seemed to be favoring Harrison Ford the whole way through, you know, probably off of the success of Indiana Jones and hoping to, curry favor with him for another project or whatever. There's nothing in there I can really point to that he brought to it that George Lucas didn't, because, you know, everything I've read about this movie is like, it was very much George Lucas's movie. And, you know, Gary Kurtz, who was the producer on New Hope and Empire, was fired before this one started. And, you know, people have their opinions about it. I feel like if Gary Kurtz was going to, you know, do something really interesting in the aftermath of that, he probably would have, you know. And it's like, I feel like there's a thing that's very telling after these movies when, whenever there's like a band that kind of splits up, it's like, you see what people do in their solo careers. Mm-hmm. And that tells you like, okay, George Lucas like made American Graffiti, Indiana Jones, and Star Wars. And it's like, point to what Gary Kurtz has produced since then.
Right.
Of that's like been of any note. And, you know, I know a lot of people were like very much blaming him for, you know, Return of the Jedi taking, you know, more kid friendly tone or whatever that means. But or they're blaming Lucas firing this Gary Kurtz producer for that. But it's, you know, I mean, to me, it's like this is George Lucas's thing. And, you know, for better or worse, he got to make these movies the way he wanted. And, you know, it's like I highly doubt Marquand really brought that much to the table with it, just based on the interviews that I've read of it and based on kind of what he did afterward. And, you know, I know he passed away at a fairly young age, I'm pretty sure.
I think he was 50.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely not a very old man, but, you know, it's like it's just a lot of times it's kind of telling what these guys do. Actually, he died 4 years after Return of the Jedi, which I had no idea about. That's kind of, I mean, so, all right, maybe not in that case, but, you know, with Gary Kurtz, certainly, it's like he, you know, probably would have done something else. But yeah, to me, it's like he, and part of, I mean, this is venturing into hot take territory, and you know, this is just my opinion. Like, please don't send anyone after me for this. But one of the things I kind of wish had been done in like the new Disney movies is like I for whatever people's hangups were with The Force Awakens, I think it would have been really nice to have one director kind of like staying over the course of these movies to kind of like keep a trajectory on them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if it's like, whatever, if like we'd swapped out Rian Johnson with J.J. Abrams on the first one, and then, you know, we'd gotten the Rian Johnson trilogy or whatever. It's just, to me, it seems like you kind of need a level of, like you need a consistent voice going through something like that in the way that, you know, the original Indiana Jones trilogy had it, where, you know, everyone has their favorite entry from that, but those are all Spielberg movies. Mm-hmm. And like, they all feel like Spielberg movies. And that's just my take on it. That was a very long tangent. But anyhow, yeah, that's my two cents on it.
Okay. So let me throw something out at you. And again, this is tangential, but, obviously, this is an issue that is near and dear to my heart. I don't feel like, well, I don't know. On the one hand, you know, people just say, well, these are all Lucas movies. And sometimes people forget that he didn't direct the second two. And then other times, the lesser quality of Return of the Jedi, according to some people, is attributed to Richard Marquand. What I don't hear necessarily is exactly what you're talking about, is sort of this acknowledgement of the open secret that while he was the director, he was essentially kind of a director for hire, and Lucas was sort of directing over his shoulder. And yet, as I said, near and dear to my heart is the Poltergeist controversy, where we almost collectively will never give credit to Tobe Hooper, and we just say, well, Steven Spielberg directed that. But I don't hear necessarily those same conversations about Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. I mean, and the Tobe Hooper one, I think, is so weird, because it's like, I don't know why people like gun so hard on for him on that one. Like, that one, I think, is really bizarre. I've never really gotten that argument, because it's like, you just never hear that on any of the other movies that Spielberg has produced, right, where it's like, well, Spielberg directed it. It's right. Like, everyone like had it out for Tobe Hooper from, you know, whatever rumors kind of came about during that time, and they just held over for years and years. And, you know, I mean, to Toby's credit, like, he never really let that get to him. And, you know, I think that's, and honestly, I need to, speaking to that, I think it's very cool that like Mick Garris had,
yes,
you know, Caroline Williams and Bill Moseley on to talk about that. And, you know, and then Mick was like, look, I was on set and Tobe directed this. Yeah. Like, Spielberg was certainly involved because he's the fucking biggest producer in Hollywood, and right, obviously you're going to be taking notes from him. And right, you know, that's kind of the way these things work on these huge movies. But you know, to me, it's like that in my mind, it's always, that's always been the Tobe Hooper movie. And I think certainly in light of him passing away, like, we can just go ahead and give that one to him rather than trying to like retroactively say Spielberg directed it.
I wish we could, but just last week I was talking about, I'm going to be like hosting a screening of Poltergeist around here in October. And one of the guys I was talking to said like, oh yeah, I would love to like come up here and debate you and like convince you that Spielberg directed it. So people are still beating that drum.
Well, I mean, it's like, I don't know why they think like Spielberg needs another
right,
victory
right,
like
right,
that. It's like, dude, the guy's right, like,
or why we know, need to take away the biggest box office success from, you know, another filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's like Tobe, you know, I think he had a much more checkered filmography, you know, over the course of, you know, from making like Eggshells to Chainsaw to, mm-hmm, you know, Eaten Alive and Funhouse and Spontaneous Combustion and all these other movies. And it's like, there's definitely some, you know, real gems in there. Like, Life Force is awesome. I love the Funhouse. You know, the Chainsaw 2 is a blast. Mm-hmm. But Poltergeist is amazing, obviously, but you know, it's just sort of odd to, I don't know why. It's like people just get set on this like groupthink thing, even though no one was there. No one has any like real proof to kind of base that on. And they've just all collectively decided Spielberg actually directed this movie and Toby Hooper had nothing to do with it. Whereas with Return of the Jedi, there's a lot of reports from the other actors and stuff being very open. Like, yeah, George Lucas basically had to finish this movie and he was the boss on set and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. You know, I mean, like that carries a lot more weight to me than whatever fandom kind of thinks at the moment and then, you know, decides to rally around.
There are, you know, I feel like there are shots in Return of the Jedi that I don't see in the previous films. There's that amazing sort of tracking shot during the Luke Vader lightsaber battle.
Oh yeah. Yeah. When they're going through like, past the stairs and stuff.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I don't feel, and then when Luke is, and I don't know if this is because it's something they were just grabbing, but after the Emperor is killed and Luke is sort of trying to bring Vader out to the ship and they're on the floor of the Death Star and it's chaos because people are running around, where it's kind of handheld all of a sudden, that I think that shot has always stuck out to me because it has such a different energy. And again, I don't know if these are Richard Marquand choices or if this was something, you know, built into the fabric of what was storyboarded by Lucas or whoever did the storyboards, but there are, I think, shots in this film that to me have a different energy than either of the previous two films.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could see that, and I don't know. I mean, I guess kind of like undoing my earlier point, we're probably never going to know. It's just, you know, from what I have read about it and sort of like the consensus around the cast, who I don't think they have any reason to lie about that. Mm-hmm. It's like they certainly weren't, you know, making Star Wars movies, and you know, from, it's like that was not their bread and butter for the past 30 years, like the cast. And so I don't think, or I mean, maybe it was in other senses of, you know, going to conventions or doing whatever work that stemmed from these movies, but yeah, I mean, it's like they generally like don't really have a reason to lie about it. It's like I've never seen, you know, back to the Poltergeist thing, I've never seen like Craig T. Nelson or Joe Beth Williams come out and say like, actually, Toby Hooper had nothing to do with this. And
what's her name did? Zelda Rubinstein did.
Yeah, but I mean, that's one opinion, yeah. Versus like there have been a lot of people who have said that about Jedi, right, including. You know, I think Mark Hamill has come out and said that, and you know, Peter Mayhew and David Prowse, and mm-hmm. you know, some of the actors have certainly come forward and said that. But yeah, I mean, it's like I'm sure there are things that Marquand kind of brought to it, but it is interesting watching the legacy and Return of the Jedi, because it's like they don't really feel like they were made by the same person. Like there's not a kind of like there was a definite voice in the legacy that you see where this is like a really specific filmmaker for what he was making, but virtually none of that is carried into Return of the Jedi. And you know, if you watch A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi, you're like, yeah, these kind of all came from the same person. Mm-hmm. And that's always been my take on it.
I feel like of the three movies, and again, I didn't rewatch the other two prior.
No,
to
I didn't
this.
Either.
but as I was watching it today, and again, maybe it's just because this is the last in a trilogy, and so they are tying up so many things at once. But, you know, Star Wars, the original Star Wars, and I think Empire does the same thing. You know, they're kind of famous for these last acts where we're cross-cutting multiple, you know, set pieces or multiple action taking place all at the same time. And Jedi, for me, has always had my favorite example of that, where we have the sort of ground-level stuff taking place on Endor, but it's still, you know, a big battle. We have the space stuff with Lando in kind of a dogfight, and then we have the sort of heavier character stuff, the sort of Shakespearean ending taking place on the Death Star with just Luke and Vader and the Emperor, and sort of the difference between those three things, that one is big and noisy and all the way down to something that's very sort of quiet and filled with this sort of dramatic heft. Jedi has my favorite instance of that kind of cross-cutting action to wrap up the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really cool getting to see, you know, Lando put into like a good hero leadership role where he's, you know, piloting the Millennium Falcon with
Nien Num,
or however you pronounce it.
Right.
You know, blowing up the Death Star, like, that's fucking awesome. I love seeing Leia and Han and the Ewoks, you know, destroying this Imperial base and taking it over. That's really fun. And then, you know, you have this, like you said, this kind of Shakespearean climax between, you know, Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker, and the Emperor. And, you know, it's excellent. It's like, I don't know how you could watch that and not be into it.
I was filled with appreciation too for Ian McDiarmid's characterization of the Emperor, because again, so many of these things are just sort of woven into our DNA because we grew up watching it, and so there are all these things that I've just always accepted as like, yeah, that's Return of the Jedi, that's Star Wars. Like, I just accept these movies for what they are without ever really stepping back and saying like, oh, what works, what doesn't work, what's cool about this? You know, the first shot of Luke with those massive doors opening and him just silhouetted, I'm like, well, that's a really, really cool visual.
Oh yeah, that's a great entrance.
Right. And so I've always just accepted like, oh yeah, that's the Emperor, he's the worst, you know. But watching it today, I was like, wow, I really need to give Ian McDiarmid, and he was always good in the prequels as well. But man, he was so good in Jedi at creating a character who is loathsome with his every word, every single thing he says, and the way he articulates every word, he's the worst.
Well, one of my favorite things in it is when he says like, oh, I'm afraid it will be quite operational. Like that whole, like, I eat that up with a knife and fork. That is so, it just, his delivery on that is exquisite. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, for my money, I think he's like one of the best villains in anything ever. I mean, he's just phenomenally evil and just, he's so, so good at it. It's like, I just have such a blast watching him, you know, play that role. It's just, I mean, that's one of those things where it's like, I can't imagine anyone else playing that character. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just so exquisitely evil that it is really hard to imagine anyone else pulling that off.
What are your feelings about the second Death Star in two movies?
You know, I mean, that's one of the things that it's a little bit just going back to the well and, you know, kind of being like, well, what do we have, you know, in the bank here? Like, oh, we could do this again. And it's like, I don't think it's definitely nowhere near as gratifying seeing that blow up the second time as, you know, it is when Luke blows it up in the original mm-hmm. movie. It's just, you know, I think maybe if I did have some criticism of it, that would certainly be one of the points. Like, I think it would have been really cool if Lando had, you know, blown something else up. I mean, maybe not just another Death Star, like some, you know, I'm sure they could have created some other, you know, gigantic intergalactic weapon. But I think it's fine. It's never really bothered me, but I see why people complain about it. I think it's a little more egregious in The Force Awakens, yes, that they have to make the jump to, like, now it's going to blow up five planets, where it's like, okay, like, this is just absurd at this point, because it's like, what, I mean, you know, when we're old men, like, what are they going to do? It's like, oh, it's going to wipe out like 100 planets or something. And it just, it feels a little silly, but,
well, and it was a, you know, one of the complaints about Jedi. And so then with 20 or 30 years of perspective, they just kind of double down on that decision and they're like, nah, we'll do it again. Like,
yeah,
wow,
no,
that's a weird choice, but okay.
Well, it's a lot of the stuff they've done in the new ones, I think, is like weird, like corrections from what people didn't like in either the prequels or in Jedi, or actually not even Jedi. It's like things people didn't like in the prequels or the special editions, where, you know, I think the most obvious one is in Force Awakens. They, you know, Han and Chewie are running from these guys, and then Han like throws that guy into that monster, you know, right away to just set up,
right.
Like, oh, this is the Han Solo you remember from the despecialized editions. And he, you know, he'll like throw this guy into this monster in order to like get away or get ahead. And it's like, okay, be like, fine. You know, like, I don't think that's unlike him. I think it's a little weird that he's dressed exactly the same way as a 70-year-old man and hanging out with the exact same guy that, you know, he's like, and doing all the exact same things he was as a, you know, 35-year-old man now that he's had like a wife and a kid.
Well, and that's the part that's disappointing, is that it suggests that there were all these years where he was a different guy. But we don't get to see any of that. We just get to see him be Han Solo again. And they just tell us, like, oh, yeah, by the way, I had all these adventures. I totally changed. I was married. I had a kid. I was a different man. But now you catch up with me and I'm just Han Solo again.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I certainly get the appeal of doing that, because it's like everyone grew up loving Han Solo and Indiana Jones. And, you know, Harrison Ford is basically everyone in our age bracket. He was like our hero growing up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you get the opportunity to put him in a movie, obviously you're like, oh, this is so cool. I get to like write Han Solo or whatever. But, you know, one of the things I've always really liked is when they give like a real progression or maturity to these characters. And the one I think they did this perfectly with was Creed, the Ryan Coogler movie with Rocky, where it's like, okay, you know, he's like, had a wife that died, his brother-in-law died, he owns a restaurant now, and he has like a lot of regrets about his life, his kids don't really talk to him. He's kind of this like broken down guy who gets like a second chance to go and, you know, train this guy, you know, who is his friend's son, and maybe help him like recapture some of his greatness through that, versus like Rocky's getting back in the ring one more time to like take out you know, Ivan Drago or whatever they were, you know, whatever that really dumb.
Well, which is what they're doing now, right? Aren't they doing like Ivan Drago's kid for Creed 2?
Yeah, but I mean, it's like that's still, there's still weight to that in a way. It's like, I don't, as much as I love, you know, Stallone as an actor from, you know, Rocky and Rambo and Nighthawks and, you know, a zillion other movies, it's like, putting him back in the ring with him being in his 70s is ludicrous. Yeah. And I mean, it's like, there's just no way around it. And it's like, yeah, it might hit some fun sort of like nostalgia buttons on that, but it's a lie, you know? And it's like, it's inauthentic. It's not true to that character or what that story should be or any of that. And, you know, Ryan Coogler, I think, was absolutely dead on with every choice he made in that movie for, you know, keeping him as this trainer and, you know, like letting him have his own arc and, you know, really allowing him to mature and have gone through some changes that he kept, you know, from Rocky Balboa to Creed or what have you. And, you know, that was one of the things I really felt was kind of missing in Force Awakens, was you're just like, he's just doing all the same stuff he was in the original movie. And it's like, that's not, people change over time. Like, I don't care who you are. It's like life does things to you, and you end up, you know, having experiences that really like cause you to reevaluate where you are and how you approach things. And it's like, you just, your relationships with people and, you know, the world and your community or whatever change over time. And to kind of not do that, I think is a big mistake. Like, I would have loved to have seen, I mean, kind of going back to another fine tangent here, but Crystal Skull, one of the things I think is really egregious about that movie is, again, he's, you know, a guy in his late 60s acting exactly the same way he did when he was in his mid-30s. Right. And it's not like the really cool version of that, I think, would have been, you know, kind of doing like an Unforgiven type of thing with Indiana Jones, where it's like, what happens when he's old and hasn't done this in 20 years and has to like figure out how to do that again? Or it's like almost taking that angle of, I don't know if you've seen that John Wayne movie, the Shootist, yeah, or, you know, the Coen Brothers True Grit. It's like taking that angle and being like, okay, what if he was actually old and had to do this again? Like, what does that look like? Because that's a really interesting story there that we haven't seen. It's like, yeah, we've gotten plenty of, you know, Indy or Han kicking ass and, you know, being like the swaggery cool guy. But it's just, I felt like there was definitely a missed opportunity there to do something really, really strong with him. And yeah.
That's, you know, unfortunately kind of the curse of a lot of these like legacy remakes is, or sequels rather, is that, you know, we just have to deliver what worked before instead of saying like, okay, who are these people now? What point might they be in their lives? And like you said, Creed does that pretty well. I even felt like, and I only saw it once, so I don't remember Rocky Balboa too well, but I remember feeling like it wasn't the fight, like some sort of charity thing because a video game had existed and there was a question of like, hey, could Rocky Balboa beat the current champ? I was like, well, that's kind of an interesting way to get him back in the ring, where it's just sort of this exhibition thing that comes from a video game. I was like, all right, I'm on board for that.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, I think it was like a what if fight. Yeah. They basically like were able to kind of simulate what Rocky at his peak would have been like versus essentially what was Floyd Mayweather.
Right.
And they were, which is a really cool, you know, question to ask, and it's interesting. I do like that movie, and but I mean, it's also too, it's like, I think the way for them to make a movie after Rocky Balboa was to do what they did with Creed, where it's like, okay, let's like make him a side character, you know, do, and tell the story of like Apollo's son, which is awesome, you know, and that's, that I'm 100% on board with. It just seems weird. It's like, okay, Han and Leia had this whole life that you never got to see in any facet. Now that they like wiped out every, you know, extended universe thing or whatever from like the past 25 something years. And so you're like, okay, all that stuff where it's like, you did find out what they were doing after Return of the Jedi no longer counts. And we're actually not going to show you any of what happened to them between that. And you're like, okay, cool. You're like, well, I get, like, I don't know. It's that must have been interesting, whatever happened there. And it's just kind of an odd jumping off point. I mean, I sent this to you earlier, or we were talking about this earlier, but there was this interview with Mark Hamill from 1983 that I watched kind of in preparation for this podcast. But, you know, he was talking about, he's like, oh yeah, George is going to have us come back in the year 2000 and we're going to do like a sequel trilogy and I'm going to be on like another plane of existence and I'm going to have like a kid and all this other stuff. And I was like, God, that sounds really fucking interesting. I was like, I would have loved to have seen whatever that would have been. But I mean, it's like, you know, just off of that, you can tell it's like, that was not going to just be a repeat of the greatest hits of, you know, the original trilogy or whatever, which, I mean, it's like, there's a very weird thing too that only kind of exists in these movies because they have the weight of 40 years of expectations on them. And it's like, it's essentially like making a sequel to the Shining, which granted, I know Stephen King wrote Dr. Sleep, but that's still such a kind of different, like almost like spinoff type of thing. But I mean, it's like, it's just very rare to have any property have that kind of weight on it going forward. So it's like, there's almost no way to do it without it disappointing almost everyone. And I think there it's kind of an interesting scenario to be in. And I don't know if the answer is to just leave those movies alone and let them turn into like Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever these other movies that are clearly influenced by them, or to, you know, go back to how they were making them in the 70s and just have them be these crazy kind of like filmmaker, you know, auteur visions. Or I have no idea what the answer is, because it's a pretty unique problem to have. Like, we didn't have that when the, you know, it's like, imagine, you know, the Bela Lugosi Dracula had been like the biggest thing in the world, and then Coppola had come along and made his version in the 90s or whatever. It's like, and that had, you know, 40 years of gigantic expectations on it. It's like, people that would watch that movie would probably have like a pretty negative take on it. Or, you know, I mean, it's like there's just a lot of these scenarios that are very unique to our time in cinema, because it's like, we have stuff where it's like someone's, you know, I mean, Hugh Jackman played Wolverine for almost 20 years, and it's like, now they have this thing of having to recast him. It's like, can you think of any other actor that played a role for that length of time, like consistently, where they'd have like a movie out every, you know, 2 to 3 years?
Not one character, I don't think, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I can't think of a single one of them. I mean, that's almost like if Sean Connery had played James Bond until GoldenEye. You know, I mean, it's like, it's a really weird thing to think about, where you're like, God, that would have been so strange to kind of see that person just like thoroughly own this role to the point where it's like, there's such, I mean, it's like, you saw how, you know, when they did The Dark Knight back in 2008 or whatever, like the internet before that movie came out, they absolutely despised the casting of Heath Ledger as the Joker. I mean, like, people were so venomous. They were like, oh, this is the guy from 10 Things I Hate About You. This is fucking bullshit. And, you know, it got to, and then it's like, as soon as that movie opened, everyone loved it. And they were, and then he's like everyone's favorite part of that movie. And so, I don't know. I think a lot of the expectations on these things are generally kind of wrong. And it's not until, you know, a little bit of time has gone by that people can kind of like accurately assess them.
Well, right. And there's no room for that or any nuance in a discussion, because we have to react to everything right away. And it's like, again, because Star Wars belongs to everyone, because everyone thinks they own a piece of Star Wars, or they love Star Wars more than their neighbor. You know, the Force Awakens had this hard job to do, because the prequels had, you know, kind of turned a lot of people off of Star Wars. So it was like, well, we got to get them back. So let's remind them of what Star Wars was. And they played it pretty safe. And it's an entertaining movie, but they played it pretty safe. And so then the pushback was, well, you played it too safe. It's too much like, you know, the other Star Wars movies. Okay. So here's The Last Jedi, and it's going to do some things that are different. And it's a little bit more maybe auteur driven than The Force Awakens, which felt a little bit more like a committee thing. And then there's pushback against that. And so now they go back to J.J. Abrams, and it's like, there's no winning, you know? And obviously, I mean, the movies are very successful and plenty of people like them. So it's not like, oh no, poor Kathleen Kennedy, what's Star Wars going to do? But it's just, every direction is sort of the wrong one to a group of people. And I guess it just depends who's loudest, like what the new direction is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's just I just think it's odd too, because it's like these are very rushed movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, you look at, you know, there were six movies that came out over the course of like 20 something years, basically. Because, you know, yeah, I mean, it was like the first ones in 1977. Revenge of the Sith came out in, you know, 2005. And now it's like we've had almost as many entries in the Star Wars universe in this new kind of like Disney cycle as there have been over basically 30 years, which is a little greedy, maybe. I don't know. It's just, it seems like they're a bit rushed, but yeah, they're kind of in a, I think they're in a little bit of a lose-lose situation, because honestly, the way these movies are made now, I don't think George Lucas would have been able to like make the original Star Wars, which everyone loved, in this current environment, you know, where it's right. Like these things are just so dialed in ahead of time that, you know, it's kind of like a miracle when any of these blockbuster movies come out halfway decent, because there's just so many people to answer to in these things. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I don't really feel like there's a solution for it, because ultimately it's like you're always going to end up disappointing someone who's like a diehard fan of this, whatever you do with it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know if the answer is, you know, to make more movies like The Last Jedi, or if it's to like, I mean, to me, it almost seems like you need to go and kind of like let the thing alone and then do these like Guardians of the Galaxy type movies that were influenced by it, but they're different, you know, where it's like you just take the thing people like and then don't rehash the same story and, you know, get to tell like a new tale with a fresh set of characters that, you know, are clearly influenced by it, but it's not kind of like hitting all these same set pieces or plot points or what have you.
I saw somebody on Twitter. I wish I could remember who it was so I could give them credit. They wrote something like, The Wizard of Oz had, you know, four different directors, and none of us knew that growing up. We just saw The Wizard of Oz, and we loved it. And think about, you know, the all the backstory with Solo, and the movie's going to come out and the internet's going to be filled with pieces about like, well, which stuff is Ron Howard's and which stuff is Lord and Miller? And, you know, some of us sitting in the audience are going to be sitting there trying to figure out, okay, is this from the first version, or is this what Ron Howard brought in? I mean, it happened with Justice League. Everybody sat there, which scenes are Joss Whedon's, you know? And it's no way to see a movie, because nobody watching The Wizard of Oz growing up was trying to figure out which scene is Victor Fleming's and which one is this person.
Yeah, completely. It's, I mean,
to what you were saying, like Lucas could not have made his Star Wars movies in the current system because of exactly, you know, we just cannibalize everything to death.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so weird. Like, I saw something. God, I can't remember. Someone posted, I think this was on Twitter or something, but they were like combing through the latest TV spot for the Avengers, trying to figure out which character dies in it, you know? God. And you're like, I mean, so they're like examining these background shots, and I'm just like, why even watch it at that point?
Right.
You like it just is such an odd thing to do, because it's like the part of the reason why I like going to these movies is to see what a specific filmmaker will do with the material, where it's like, okay, what is Jody Hill's Texas Chainsaw Massacre look like, or like you know, something. I mean, that's completely out of my ass, but
not a bad idea.
You know, stuff like, yeah, I mean, that could actually be kind of cool. But, you know, it's like you want to be surprised and kind of see what they do with the material. And, you know, this thing of like trying to predict who's going to die ahead of time for this like big summer event. It's just like, is there any, like, do you get any joy out of that? Or is it just a thing of like, I was right about this? Or, I don't really understand the mentality, but yeah, this whole thing of just kind of combing over every second of footage released, you know, before a movie comes out is very, very strange to me.
I don't understand. And I've wondered the same thing. Like, so if correctly guessing who's going to die, will you like the movie better? You know, also yeah. Does a character have to die? Like that became the thing I know. Every season finale of The Walking Dead, it was always like, well, which character is going to die? Is that why we're watching the show at this point? Like just to see who's going to die at the end of a season? Because that is not especially interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a very large part of it now, is people just trying to predict what's going to happen ahead of everyone else. And I like that it's not at all why I watch movies. You know, no. I saw You Were Never Really There last night, Lynn Ramsey movie. And like the whole time I was like, I have absolutely no idea where this is going. And I think it's amazing. Yeah. Like it absolutely blew me away. I thought it was a phenomenal film and I was completely enveloped in it. It's like, there's no point where, you know, I was like trying to guess where, you know, what was going to happen to him at the end or, you know, it's like, you just don't, I feel like you're supposed to kind of like, when a movie is made well, you're supposed to kind of like let the story play out in front of you and you have an emotional experience with it or, right. You know, and, you know, going in and just dissecting these things ahead of time really dilutes that to me. It's like, I try not to watch any trailers or TV spots or of anything I go and see and just go in as cold as possible. It's like, I'll read whatever the, you know, two line synopsis is on IMDb or whatever, mm-hmm. and just go from there. But yeah, it's a very weird thing to do.
I've become the same way where I'm like, I don't check out trailers or, you know, if I'm at the movies and they show them, okay, fine. I'm not like covering my eyes and running out of the theater or whatever. Like, fine, I'll see it. But I find that my enjoyment of movies has expanded a great deal when I don't come in knowing every story beat and every big shot and exactly what's going to happen. And sometimes that's the best part of like going to festivals, is because I don't know even what a movie is about. All I know is a title. Like, okay, here's the next movie. Okay, cool. I don't know who's in it. I don't know what it's about. And we're like so far off Return of the Jedi, but I wanted to bring something up because it ties back to your movie, Beyond the Gates. So I just was talking about Silver Bullet or writing about Silver Bullet. I don't know. Are you a Silver Bullet fan?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Silver Bullet's awesome. Anyway, so I was thinking about years ago, Quentin Tarantino gave this interview where he was talking about Silver Bullet. And he said, one of the things that's great about Silver Bullet is by the time you get to that last showdown, you don't know if Gary Busey is going to survive because of the way that the character is written, because technically he could die and the movie would be okay. You know, it's like you're not killing off your main character or whatever. And so there's a tension in that. I don't know what is going to happen to this character, and therefore you are more invested, right? And it reminds me of a little movie called Beyond the Gates, because you get to a certain point in Beyond the Gates where there are three characters in a dangerous situation. And it's especially the first time I watch it, but each time I revisit it, I'm hit with that same feeling again of, hey, obviously I know who's going to make it, but I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen to this character. And technically this character could die because the movie has been set up that way.
Yeah.
And
well,
that's I like that, you know.
Like, no,
that's,
thank you.
That's, I mean, unusual.
That's a huge, huge compliment, and I'm really grateful to hear that. That's really awesome, and yeah, thank you for saying that, because yeah, that means the world to me, and that was completely the aim, you know. Because I mean, part of what I really like in Return of the Jedi, I mean, and that was on it, quite honestly, that was a very big influence on Beyond the Gates, as far as like the father son dynamic thing goes, like not really in any other area, but that specifically, you know, was something that resonated with me at a young age. But, you know, I love those things when it's like you don't know who is going to make it out or if any of them are going to make it out. Right. And, you know, like going back to the original Phantasm, they have the whole thing with Mike and Jody and Reggie going up against the tall man in the, you know, the mortuary or whatever. And then Reggie gets killed and you're like, oh shit, you're like, oh my God, he just fucking died right there. And then, so, you know, Mike and Jody go off, stop the tall man, get to the end of it. And it's like, oh wait, actually that was a dream. Right. And in fact, Jody's dead and Reggie survived. And it's just a really cool thing when, you know, I love the effect that has on me as a viewer in these other movies when it's properly pulled off. And, you know, I loved that in Return of the Jedi because, you know, when I first watched it as a kid, I just had no idea if, like, you know, I assumed Luke was not going to die, but it's like, you know, you don't know, is Han going to make it out? Is Lando going to make it out? Is Leia going to make it out? It's like, there's certainly a very real possibility that they could get killed, you know, and because it's like, this is the last one, all bets are off. And, I've always really dug that. And I mean, I think, Quentin talked about this on, the True Romance commentary, but he pointed out, you know, when Alabama gets, when she's in the hotel room fighting with James Gandolfini, it's like, she could totally get killed in that scene.
Right.
And then it would, like, you know, turn into a little bit of a different movie where it's like, okay, Clarence is going to go and get revenge and kill, you know, these other, whoever at that point. But it's like, she's in serious peril, at least. And you know that as a viewer, like, if they'd switched that scene and Clarence had been in there, you'd kind of know he was not going to get killed there. Right. I mean, but putting her in that scenario, you're like, yeah, she could die here. And you do not want that to happen. I think that's the best, you know?
And I think now the reverse is sort of a little bit true, where, like, I feel like I'm more surprised when a filmmaker makes the choice to not kill characters, because it has, like, if I go into Infinity War and no one dies, I will have zero complaints, because I'm going in expecting that, because there's this idea, especially with some of these franchises, whether it's Fast and Furious or even what we're seeing happen with these new Star Wars movies. There's this idea that with each movie, we have to kill off these characters because that raises the stakes. And I just don't know if I buy into that. I mean, it goes all the way back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show with Friday the 13th. Like, I'm just never a fan of, in some of these horror franchises, where someone survives and then they bring them back and kill them in the first 5 minutes of the next movie. Like, to me, that doesn't raise the dramatic stakes. That just shits on a character that I liked.
I'm completely the same way, because, you know, one of the things I've just noticed in a lot of, not all modern horror movies, but a lot of them, it's like they'll have a thing where it's like, oh, we have to kill everyone. Like, everyone dies at the end. Yes. No one makes it out. And it's like, to me, it is so much more shocking to get to, like, the end of It Follows, where it's like, oh, the two leads are still alive, you know? And it's like, yeah, the thing's coming right after them. And, like, you know, they might not be alive much longer than that, but they get through it. And, you know, those two made it out, even though the thing's right behind them. And, you know, they're probably not safe for much longer. They still survived. And one of the things I was so shocked by in this past summer, and I wasn't crazy about this movie, but I did really like this choice, and it was in Alien Covenant. I could not believe that Danny McBride survived that movie. I was like, I remember looking at the publicity stills, so I was like, there is no way that he is not going to get killed in this. And then when he made it to the end, I was like, holy shit, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I was like, I never thought he would have made it out of this. And so I almost think that's a bolder choice now. Like, you know, I mean, it's also, too, with, you know, in the current set of Star Wars movies that they're doing, it's like they have this thing of like, oh, we have to like kill one of them per movie.
Right.
And it's like, I don't know why they need to do that. It's like, I didn't feel that, you know, Han Solo's death, like, did anything like really mind blowing or whatever. It's like, you see Obi-Wan die in A New Hope, and it's like there's some real weight and gravitas to that. Whereas even though Han Solo is getting murdered by his son, it's like you just, I didn't feel very much watching that, even though he was my hero growing up. And I, you know, love Harrison Ford. I think he's phenomenal. And I, you know, love the original Star Wars trilogy. It was just getting to that point. I was like, yeah, I kind of felt like that was going to happen. Right. You know, it's like,
and the
it
way
didn't
it's
really...
staged, you know, it's coming, and it's like everything about it is like, okay, but now what? You know, now there's no more Han Solo in the movie, but has it changed the direction of any of these characters? Even Kylo Ren doesn't feel that much different, even though, well, you know.
I'll ask you this. Does him doing that make him more menacing?
No, not to me. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about with Return of the Jedi. See how we tie it back? Where it's like this idea of, you know, killing the father is like that's the line you can't come back from, you know, and that's where you have to fully embrace this thing that you are. And I know that that's sort of what they're going for with him killing Han Solo, but I don't feel like it's achieved in the same way that, like, Luke not killing his father in Return of the Jedi carries a lot more, for me, emotional weight than Kylo Ren killing, you know, my favorite character in the series.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like you know, you get to that point and it's like you just kind of feel nothing because it just feels very telegraphed and kind of expected. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's almost, I weirdly enough, like I kind of read some like fan theories or whatever ahead of Force Awakens coming out. And one of them sounded super interesting where it was like, Luke accidentally killed Han Solo and basically like had to kill Kylo Ren because he was like this super evil bad guy. And it was part of this like Jedi prophecy, and Han Solo's dying wish was for him to like protect his son. And I was like, whoa, that would have been really interesting.
Right,
if like,
right.
Like imagine if Luke had killed Han or something like that. And like, granted, I don't want that to happen, but it just felt like there wasn't any real surprises in that movie. Whereas, you know, in Return of the Jedi, it is a huge surprise to have Darth Vader turn into the hero mm-hmm. of the story. And it's like that, no one sees that coming when you watch it for the first time. And there's also too, going over those three movies, there's not any real foreshadowing of that either. It's like they have a couple conversations, but Vader is very much line drawn in the sand. Like I'm a bad guy. I am not changing. This is who I am. You like, you're a fool to think anything else. Like, forget it. And when that turn comes, it feels very earned, very real, and very surprising, and not, you know, not done with a lot of foreshadowing or tee up or any kind of like obvious telegraphing the way it, you know, Force Awakens did with Han, where it's just, you see as soon as they're out there and he starts walking out on the bridge, you're just like, oh, he's dead.
Right,
and that's the end of it. And you're like, okay.
Because again, we have all this insight into like, well, they probably only had Harrison Ford for one movie because we know about his contract, you know, like we know all this weird backstory that informs us now where we realize like, okay, he's only coming back to do this one movie because we've read all these different news items. So we expect him to, die. And let me ask you this though. I'm generally able to divorce myself from other sequels or other, films in a series when I'm watching movies. So like I can watch The Matrix without really in the back of my head being like, oh, and here's where it's going to go. You know, I can just kind of take it as a standalone thing.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about, you know, Vader's turn and becoming the hero at the end of this film. And I completely buy it, and it works. And I think some of that is because, again, I grew up watching this movie. So I had a backstory in my head of who Anakin Skywalker was and how he made that turn to the dark side, but how this character is still there, and to see his son in pain is more than he can bear, and that's why he chooses to make this, you know, sacrifice.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now that that's all filled in by the prequels, if I actually do sit down and say, okay, now let me think about the prequels and apply what I know to this moment in Return of the Jedi, those two things don't add up for me. Like, the Anakin Skywalker that we end Revenge of the Sith with, I don't see as the same guy who makes that choice at the end of Return of the Jedi.
No, and I mean, some of it too is, it's just the story that I think existed in our heads for what we imagined, where they came from and what Obi-Wan was like, you know, before those movies started, and, you know, what their relationship, you know, what Vader's relationship with him was and all this other stuff. It's like, you get a sense there were, these people had lives before that, you know, the original A New Hope started, and that was kind of enough. And so to see that filled in the prequels, I think, is fine. And, you know, I'm glad they exist, but it's like, I don't really feel like you need that in order for, like, the first three movies to be effective and stand on their own merits. And I mean, and quite honestly, to me, it's like, I think the story is just kind of done at the end of this one.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there was clearly no tee up or, like, another threat or anything else. And so, I mean, in kind of the same way that it's like The Last Crusade, the story's kind of done at the end of that movie.
Right.
It's like, you don't really need to catch up with Indy 20 years later or whatever and see what he's up to. It's just like, he reconnected with his dad, went on this journey, you know, and then, like, rode off into the sunset with Salad, Marcus, and, you know, his father, and that's kind of enough. And it's like, you know, you can count Crystal Skull or not, but you basically can just look at those as, like, three movies that tell a complete story and don't really need to lump Crystal. I mean, you can lump Crystal Skull in there if you want, but I don't. And it's like, to me, it's like, I feel like it's done in kind of the way that, you know, the first three Star Wars movies, they just tell a complete story that I'm satisfied with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't really need to put the others in there.
Well, and I would almost think there's a way to do these new movies that, with just a few changes, I think you can divorce it from the original trilogy and just tell a new story with new characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can certainly reference the Force and Jedi and Luke Skywalker, you know, but the actual characters themselves don't necessarily have to show up, and they don't all have to be related, and we don't have to kind of close the universe off so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it would be more interesting at this point to just see, like, there was some rumor going around that they were going to do, like, a Seven Samurai type Star Wars movie.
Zack Snyder was going to do it.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, whatever was going to happen with that, I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. Like, that's a new thing that I haven't seen before. And it's honestly, too, it's much closer in tone to what the inspiration for the original movies were, because he was so influenced by Kurosawa. And it's like, I think almost going back to those types of movies and seeing what they did is the way to do it, rather than looking back at the original trilogy and trying to copy that. It's like, I think they should be going back to the stuff that influenced Lucas and these other filmmakers, and being like, okay, well, what does that inspire in you in the context of this universe? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I'd love it if they did, like, a cool Yojimbo Star Wars movie, maybe with, like, a new character or something. Like, that would be awesome. But it just seems like they're very badly trying to recreate the past in sort of in a way that can't be captured again, even with all the money in the world and Harrison Ford coming back and all this crazy manpower going into it, it's just not going to be the same thing, because so many of these movies are just products of the circumstances that they were made in, the time they were made in, what was available to them, like the constraints that they had. I mean, it's like if you look at Jaws and see what would that movie have been like if the shark had worked the whole time?
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like it would have been very different. And it's like, would it have been Jaws? Maybe. But I think things worked out for a reason on that movie. And it's like those things that were kind of setbacks or whatever at the time ended up being like huge advantages over the course of cinema history.
Yeah. Let me bring up one more thing and then I'll let you go, because I don't want to take up your whole night. So I'm watching the specialized edition today, and we get to the song at the end, and I like it because it's what I grew up with, and the Ewoks are dancing around and everyone's together, and it's, you know, there's no dialogue. It's just characters sort of, hey, it's you, and giving each other hugs, and we won. And then I was thinking about the special editions, or the special edition rather, and how it was changed. The music was changed, but more notably, Lucas cuts away to a bunch of other, like, planets, worlds, all celebrating, almost like the end of Independence Day when we jump around to all the different countries cheering because the spaceships are falling down. That's kind of what it reminds me of. And I was thinking about why that bothered me so much. And it wasn't just because it was different, and it wasn't just because they took away the song that I recognized. I really feel like it's because it's a weirdly dishonest moment, in that I haven't seen the Empire interact or have an effect on any other planets or races. Like,
I see, totally.
So for them to be happy, sort of ding dong, the witch is dead, I'm just like, well, who are these people? What was their life like under the Empire? Why do I care that they are rejoicing? Like, to me, it really only is about the rebellion. And I get that the galaxy is better off without the Empire in charge, because of course I get that. But to see just random races and planets celebrating just feels weirdly dishonest to me, when all we've known is this group of people. That's who we should be celebrating with.
Yeah, no, I agree 100% on it. I think that was one of the weirder... I mean, and to be quite honest, that change actually bothered me a lot more. Well, that and the song in Jabba's Palace, but those two changes bothered me a lot more than, you know, Greedo shooting first. Right. Like that one, I'm like, yeah, no, it undercuts a really great character moment from the original movie, but it's like changing the song felt really strange, because like I don't really like that song very much, and I liked the one in the original just fine. And it's like seeing all these different planets and kind of adding to the scope of this, it's like it adds nothing to it, you know. It's like there's nothing you get out of seeing, you know, these a number of different planets and in, you know, creature races or whatever that you didn't get with, you know, these heroes you've been following for the past three movies, sitting around a campfire with a bunch of Ewoks and some robots and the ghosts of these Jedis. You know, it's like you got everything you wanted as like an appropriate catharsis for this trilogy. And it's just like, okay, yeah, it's like, it's cool that he had money to spend on those things 20 years later or what have you, but it adds nothing. And I'm in complete agreement with you there.
Anything else about Return of the Jedi that you were like, oh, I gotta get this out?
No, I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, the weight of the ending, I think is really strong. I don't know. I mean, it's like, I've just had such a, this movie's just been such like a cornerstone of like how I got into movies and, you know, getting into everything from when I was a kid, and just seeing the stuff that influenced this and all these other things that, you know, it was very huge to me. And No, I mean, that's really it. It's like, to me, like, this is like the real kind of conclusion to the Star Wars saga. And it's like, you can certainly add in, you know, the expanded universe from, you know, the books and comics or whatever, the Disney universe or whatever you want to call that. But to me, it's just, it seems like you get everything you need out of these three movies, and then everything is wrapped up really nicely at the end of this one. So that's kind of my two cents on it.
I loved learning that this movie was an influence on Beyond the Gates, because I never would have put that together, but hearing it makes sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely was. I mean, it's obviously, it's in a horror movie context where it's like, okay, you kind of have to kill this person in order to save your friend. Right. So it's a little bit more of like a confronting a monster type of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy you made that comparison. I'm honestly like kind of slightly embarrassed by that, because it's like, it's such a huge compliment. I don't quite know what to do with it, but I thank you from the bottom of my heart. That's very, very kind of you.
Well, you know that movie means a lot to me. So, and your movie has been announced. Yes.
Yeah. So we're in the process of, casting that. It's called The Day After Halloween, and it's basically examining what happens to the final girl after the end of a slasher movie. It goes in a pretty unexpected direction that I don't think anyone's going to really be able to predict, but, yeah, it's I'm really, really excited about it. I came up with this story for it with Steve Scarlatta, who was my co-writer on Beyond the Gates, and I cannot wait to make this movie. I think it's going to be really cool, and I'm just dying to get into it and get this thing done.
That is awesome, and I'm excited. Which one of the Avengers will die in it?
Hawkeye. I have no idea. We'll find out. Maybe Agent Coulson. I have no clue.
Yeah, we'll, right. We'll so far, he's the only one to die, I think. Right.
Yeah. No, I don't even know if he's. I mean, these things, they always just kind of undo them.
Right. Yeah.
True to comic books, which I'll give them credit for that. But yeah, just, you know. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for talking about this movie with me. It's always super fun to just talk about a ton of stuff with you. So I really appreciate you making the time.
Oh, thanks, dude. No, I love coming on here. It's always a blast. So I appreciate you asking me back on.
It is a pleasure. Everyone should follow Jackson on Twitter at BossJacko, and same on Instagram.
Yes, sir.
And you're making like those crazy, what do you call those that you make on Instagram?
Oh, those gifts, you mean?
Like they just, yeah, they're like gifts, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of fun with those. Like basically when I'm procrastinating from writing, I'll make these like animated gifts. They're pretty fun.
Yeah, they're really cool. Thank you guys for listening. We will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.